Hi, Alex.
Hey, Dan.
All right, so we're ready to do another episode of Blogging Heads. I'm Daniel Strauss, a reporter for Talking Points Memo, and I'm here with Alex Seitzwald of National Journal. And today we're going to talk about a few topics. We're going to hit on basically party infighting within the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And then we're going to move into the ongoing topic of Obamacare, the rollout, and how it's been portrayed lately. Alex, I really wanted to do this Blogging Heads with you because I've been a big fan of your work, both at National Journal and Salon, on sort of the outer reaches of each party and the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And you've covered the fringe and, you know, some of the more eccentric sort of examples of the fringe over the past few years. And most of my reporting so far at TPM has been on political infighting. So Republicans on Republicans and Democrats on Democrats. And right now I wanted to ask you if what's going on with the GOP from your view is a so-called GOP civil war, which is something liberals seem to gleefully label Republicans fighting with Republicans, outside groups battling with the National Republican Senatorial Committee and Mitch McConnell. So I'd love to hear your take on that to start this off and sort of really figure out if we're seeing a civil war on the right and then on the left too.
Yeah, well, and I will return the kind words and say I'm a big fan of yours too, as well, from Talking Points Memo and The Hill before that. I think it is fair to call it a civil war. I mean, obviously, there's no one has taken to muskets and bayonets out at Bull Run yet. We don't see Ted Cruz against Reince Priebus. But I really do think there is a war on for the kind of heart and soul of the Republican Party going forward. You know, if you pull back and look at the multi-decade view, I think kind of the core coalition within the Republican Party was big business elites, your kind of, you know, country club Republicans, and the social conservative, and now libertarian wing, kind of a, more rural, not as wealthy, although they do tend to be wealthier than your average people, a little bit older, white, extremely white, lacking a college education for a lot of them. So that was kind of like a base coalition that worked very well for the Republican Party for a long time. Ronald Reagan talked about the three stools, national security, Republicans, fiscal kind of Republicans, and social conservatives. And those three stools were together. But I think what's happening now is that coalition is no longer large enough to deliver a presidential election. So it's starting to rip apart at the seams, to mix my metaphors, or the stool is starting to wobble. There's really a battle going on. Is the Republican Party going to be a smaller and more ideological pure party moving forward, which is the Ted Cruz Tea Party wing, or is it going to be a larger thing moving forward? And you're also, with the rise of the Tea Party libertarian ideology, it goes up against some of the core interests of these big business elites, like using government tax breaks to favor businesses and things that have long been taken for granted, but that, real ideological libertarians don't actually favor. They say that's government picking winners and losers, just like what liberals like. So, yeah, I absolutely think there's and we could get into it, on a whole host of policy areas, from immigration reform especially is kind of one of the more obvious ones, to gay marriage, but also, on entitlements, on fiscal policy, on a whole host of things. And it's incredible. I'll just point to some polling here. My colleague Brian Resnick compiled a bunch of polling on some key questions, and pollsters have more recently started they've done this for a while, but since the rise of the Tea Party, they've started separating out Tea Party Republicans from non-Tea Party Republicans. And on almost every major policy area up for debate right now, from the size of the budget to climate change, if you look at the numbers, you have non-Tea Party Republicans generally on one side, and you have Tea Party Republicans on the other side. I mean, it's really a stark divide. I was shocked to see how big these differences were. And like one of the key questions that underlies everything is, you know, do you want your members of Congress to compromise, or do you want them to stand on their, you know, positions and not compromise? And non-Tea Party Republicans say compromise. Tea Party Republicans say don't compromise. So that's really like the key friction point from a strategy point of view. But obviously that touches like pretty much every policy area.
Yeah, I mean, the compromise thing, I think really, I'm so wary of calling it a civil war because, you know, Republicans I talk to like to say, well, this is what goes on every time the party is out of power and doesn't have the White House. There's introspection and, you know, sort of disagreement and sort of stark divides on where the party should, which direction the party should go with. But, you know, what we're seeing here over the last few months, and especially with the government shutdown, I think, and even like you said, on battles on like immigration, it's not a level of coordination or sort of, it's a lesser level of coordination than I think you would expect and that you would see in recent years. And it just seems to me like the real divide, the real threat right now, if you're a Republican, is to have someone point fingers at you and say you're not a Republican or you're not a conservative. I over the past few days, I've been thinking a lot about the Wyoming Senate race between Wyoming Republican primary between Liz Cheney and Mike Enzi.
Yeah.
And, you know, supporters of Cheney like to sort of say that Enzi maybe not as conservative as he sort of claims to be or he's known as, but he's National Journal ranks him as like one of the most conservative members of the Senate.
Yep.
And my real interpretation of like why anyone would see Enzi as less of a conservative would be that he's not like a fire breather. You know, he's not making big speeches. He's not going out there and pointing fingers and yelling and making a big hullabaloo of things. But, you know, on entitlement reforms, on gay marriage, on abortion, those are all issues that he's really, really conservative on. So I don't really know. Like, it's hard to avoid the fact that there is a definite divide. And your point about sort of even dividing within the Republican Party, Tea Party Republicans and, you know, I guess more moderate or mainstream Republicans is, I think, telling. How does that, I mean, every time I look at polls like that, I always go to the Tea Partiers, just because those numbers indicate to me where the pressure will be.
Yeah.
It seems to me that, like, you know, with the government shutdown, a lot of the GOP didn't really want to go for a shutdown over the defund Obamacare effort, but there was so much pressure to do it, you know, that they had to go in anyway on it. I recently reported on the Defending Mainstream PAC, which is a super PAC that's aiming to sort of nominate and support more mainstream Republicans, and they're not fans of Tea Partiers, and they're a small pack. It's hard for them to go up, or it's going to be hard for them to really compete with the bigger outside groups.
Yeah.
But the fact that these things exist and their like primary goal is really not to defeat Democrats, it's to keep their sort of strict part of the Republican Party in power in elected office, is pretty aggressive in its own way, I think.
Yeah, and I think we have to say like the Tea Party has been really successful, at least in the medium term that we have seen their existence. And I think it's also worth saying that, you know, when a lot of reporters, like I think probably when we're talking about the Tea Party, I won't speak for you, just the people who like actively are members of the Tea Party, it's just kind of like a catch-all, a heuristic for like the Republican base, you know, in general.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And that includes social conservatives, because if you look at all the polling data on who the Tea Partiers are, they are often, you know, anti-abortion activists or people who have been around in the conservative movement from one stream or another for a long time, or even newer people, but they line up with the kind of base pressure. But they've been really successful.
Let me ask you something further. How much of that are, you know, these sort of fringe figures that you've reported on in recent years, how much of them are sort of the wackier conservatives, and how much of them are just sort of a sub-coalition of the GOP, which is, I guess, the more conservative members, social conservatives, hardliners on fiscal policy?
I mean, well, it's a great question, because I think the answer is maybe that there isn't an either or an or there, but that they're sort of the same people. You know, I mean, wacky is in the eye of the beholder. Some of these people who have been around for a long time, you know, activists, powerful on the ground, a lot of liberals would consider them wacky, but they are actually, you know, pretty powerful, and they represent kind of the ideological purity of the right. And I think, to answer that question, it might be best to, like, make the comparison with the left, which I know you wanted to get to, too. And I think it's really important here, because yes, there are fringes on both sides. There's absolutely no doubt about that. There are some really wacky people on the left. I mean, you know, I think I would probably include a lot of, like, 9/11 truthers are probably lean left, especially under the Bush administration. You know, lots of really unsavory, wacky people on the left. But there's an old adage that I think is absolutely true, that, you know, Republicans fear their base and Democrats loathe it. So while Democrats keep an arm's distance from their base and kind of poo-poo it, and they've never really given it much power or given it much ability to dictate the party's agenda, the base is where the Republican energy comes from. So it's much more powerful. And I don't have a very good answer exactly why that is, but it's definitely true, at least in my, you know, observation. I'm happy if you disagree. But so I think what happens with the right, it's not that they're wackier, they're fringier. It's just that their fringier elements are more prominent and more powerful than on the left.
Mm-hmm. So I was talking with a reporter the other day, sort of related to this, and he said, two things. So he said the thing that is really conspicuous these days about outside groups and those more purist elements within either party is that when you go and you say, you know, we're focused on electing the true conservative or the true liberal, the supporters of those outside groups like Senate Conservatives Fund or Club for Growth, they go berserk. They are really up in arms about this. And it's the same with the left, which I want to get to in a second. So there's motivation, I think, for politicians to do something, what my boss Josh Marshall coined Obamacare McCarthyism, which is basically be like, you know, you may say you support repealing Obamacare or you oppose it, but you haven't gone far enough. Therefore, you actually don't really oppose it. There are a few examples of this. There's the Georgia Senate race. There's attacks on, like, Mitch McConnell. And there's other stuff. And there are other examples like this.
I think Ted Cruz, even during the shutdown, said if you don't support, like, our defund effort, you are a supporter of Obamacare. Like, just, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's really sort of a strange phenomenon that I see going out. And for the right, it seems to be something that is really, really, like, if you can point fingers first, you sort of insulate yourself from charges from the other side. And if you're on the attack there, and it seems like it's those elements you're talking about, the base elements that are doing that. And it sort of, you know, there's a hunger to sort of be the most conservative right now and to push that. it seems like there's incentive to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And on a whole host of issues. But, like, at the same time, just to finish this out before we go to the left, like, we're seeing examples right now of, like, there have been sort of wink-wink nudges from, like, John Boehner on immigration reform, and Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, as I understand it, are sort of tacitly moving toward a budget deal. So is that sort of an example of, like, the establishment, which is what the other side has been sort of labeled, fighting back or sort of winning, do you think?
I think that question, you know, whether the establishment is striking back is going to be, like, the big question of 2014. It got a lot of attention, you know, in the recent weeks. I am not convinced at all. You mentioned the Main Street PAC, and there's a couple others. Karl Rove has said that he'll use Crossroads and Crossroads GPS to kind of do that. And there was another one recently started that said they raised $8 million. That is interesting, but, you know, $8 million or, like, a couple of groups here and there is a penny. I mean, I think that the Koch brothers, right, you know, laugh at that. That's what they spend on breakfast every morning, or, you know, use whatever hyperbole you choose. If the establishment and Republican Party were really to come back, if those big donors, you know, who have funded the party for a long time and still do, if they really wanted to make a stand, I think we would be talking in, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars here, not 8 million here, 10 million there, but, like, this would be, they could spend essentially unlimited amounts of money. So I haven't seen it. I think they still either see some benefit or are hoping that they can still kind of channel the Tea Party. Cause it, you know, it does work for if you're like a big business kind of guy and you want taxes to be lower and you want regulations to be lower, those are your big things. You are way better off with a Tea Party run Congress, even if it is embarrassing in all kinds of ways, like the government shuts down or whatever. That's kind of a better deal for you, especially when so many of your policies don't poll particularly well. I mean, you know, most, if you just straight up asked, if you ran on a platform and straight up asked Americans, you know, like, let's cut taxes for the rich and lower regulations on Wall Street, that would not particularly do very well in an election. So, you know, this seems to be working for them. Maybe that might change. I don't know. And I'm very curious to see this budget deal that you just mentioned, which is apparently coming forward. It's kind of like the white whale of Washington, you know, an actual budget deal.
Yeah.
when it comes out, so you have Paul Ryan, you know, who's tons of cred on the right. When he comes out, and he's apparently, from what I've heard from my reporting, it's basically just Patty Murray and Paul Ryan cutting this deal, and then they're going to go out to their party and say, this is the deal. There hasn't been that much buy-in. And Paul Ryan has, you know, if anyone can do it, Paul Ryan can. But I'm still very curious if, like, the Ted Cruz wing is going to go along with it and say, yes, this is fine, or at least hold their fire, even if they don't endorse it, at least just take a step back. That would be really interesting, and that would suggest that they've kind of learned the lesson of the government shutdown. But I'm not at all convinced that's going to happen.
The really interesting thing about the Paul Ryan aspect that I think has gone on unreported so far is that he's also been making congressional endorsements over the past few months, and he's been endorsing some Tea Party favored candidates. And it's a weird way. I mean, there are a few reasons he could do that, but one way is sort of to insulate himself and to sort of seem like a coalition builder, or at least someone who both backs those candidates and then goes and talks to Democrats.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen that over the past few years, especially with a figure sort of like as well respected within the party as Paul Ryan.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So it will be like, you know, how this comes out and whether sort of the real fire breathers on the right sort of go after Paul Ryan. And Ryan is a likable, charismatic dude. It's like, it's really hard to, like, he's really young, and I don't think there was too much fault directed at him for the GOP losing the 2012 election.
Yeah. They lost in spite of him, seems to be, like, the thinking.
What does your gut say on a budget deal? Like, do you think that the fatigue over going over these things and a shutdown and all that stuff matched with just sort of a desire for anyone to cement a deal and put their name on something on that will come out with something that's not terrible.
Here's my gut, and I could totally be wrong, and I will issue a mea culpa if I am. I think that Patty Murray and Paul Ryan will come out with a deal, that they will hammer something out. But I'm not very optimistic that it will, you know, pass both chambers and make it to Obama's desk. I think it's totally possible, but just, I don't know. That's my guess. I don't know. I don't know. What do you think? And then we should maybe move on to the left, but let's get your,
yeah.
While I'm going on the record, let's go with you, put you on the spot too.
Yeah. Honestly, I am a little more optimistic than you. I think that you can't, we've gone through so many like sort of difficult sort of, processes for passing anything or getting close. And I think more than anything else, a lot of Americans like agreement and compromise deep down. I don't know. My gut says, yes, it will be relatively easy and painless, but compared to the past few years, which have been pretty horrible. So I don't know. I wanted to segue a little bit to the left. And so while we've been seeing a GOP civil war over the last few months, in the last 7 days or so, there have been something like skirmishes, or maybe like, it wasn't exactly like, I guess, Lexington and Concord, but sort of like disagreements between parts of the Democratic Party, some top policy guys at the think tank Third Way, which is sort of a vestige of Bill Clinton's sort of centrist, or I don't know how you would describe it, but that sort of Third Way approach to politicking came out with an op-ed, and they were basically criticizing the economic populism of Elizabeth Warren, especially as it applies to Wall Street, and Bill de Blasio, who are two really, really popular figures within the Democratic Party right now. And so I thought a lot of the reporting on this exaggerated it a little bit. There was sort of a back and forth. Warren, you know, slammed the op-ed, and outside groups on the left, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, MoveOn.org, I think, a few others sort of jumped in and called for lawmakers who are affiliated with Third Way to step down if they disagreed with it. And as far as I know, none of the lawmakers did that, but they denounced the op-ed. And Warren, you know, sort of strongly criticized it. So a few things about this. I mean, you know, this sort of also falls in with recent reporting about Warren and Noam Shiver's
Definitely.
New Republic piece about her running for president. And I, you know, Alex, for the life of me, like, I really don't understand. It's not that I don't understand, but, like, she said so often that she's not running for president, but there seems to still be a hunger for her to do it and for her to be like the standard bearer to apply that liberal pressure. And I kind of expect we're going to see more, at least more reported conflicts going out about this, but I don't know if that's going to happen. It's definitely not on the scale of what's going on the right, but we haven't really seen a lot of infighting within the Democratic Party over the past few years, and this is sort of like a very notable sort of spot in that, yeah. I guess. What do you think?
And just to add one point to your excellent summary, Elizabeth Warren seemed to relish this controversy, and then she did something that Matt Iglesias called the equivalent of legislative subtweeting, which I loved. And she sent a letter to the chairman of all the big banks, you know, JP Morgan, I almost said Bear Stearns, you know, Goldman Sachs.
I think Bank of America. Six of them.
Basically the six biggest banks in America, kind of shaming them to demand. This is the day after the op-ed came out, demanding that they disclose which think tanks they give money to. So essentially she was, you know, trying to shame them without mentioning the op-ed from Third Way. She was essentially trying to shame them or, you know, shake the trees and try to make some information fall about who like funded this campaign Third Way. So she was really happy for this, I think. And, you know, happy to be the standard bearer and to take it on and say, like, you know, you want to mess with me, I'm going to mess with you and come right back at it. In that Noam Schreiber piece, which I really enjoyed, the big problem with it is whether Elizabeth Warren runs for president or not. And I would agree with you that it looks unlikely at this moment. But I think he was absolutely right in to say that she captures the soul of the kind of liberal base of the party. You know, and in a way that Hillary Clinton doesn't. I think liberals are very happy with Hillary Clinton and will, you know, happily vote for her when she runs for president. And I feel very comfortable saying that. But there is something to that. I mean, especially among younger people like my generation, our generation. I know so many people, you know, who graduated and who had a tough time finding jobs, a terrible economy, and they really blamed Wall Street for that. You know, sympathetic to Occupy kind of movement and thinking, and Elizabeth Warren is really like a shining beacon, like the one person in Washington who they can kind of attach their hopes and dreams to, the same way Obama was in 2008. But yeah, the core problem here is, will she run for president or not? I don't think she will, but that doesn't mean she can't cause a lot of trouble in the meantime. And like, I think her letter to the banks is a good indication of how she might go about doing that. And if she were to run, you know, I think in an ideal world for her, she would run, but not with any intention of actually, you know, becoming president, but purely to put her issues on the table, move Hillary Clinton a little bit to the left on certain things. And just influence in the debate in a very important way, which is, you know, and I almost hope she does run, just so that Clinton is not, you know, anointed, as such. And I don't think her denials really mean anything. Obama said for a million times that he would not run, and then he did
run.
You know, these things never,
well, that's a good point.
Yeah. These things don't really mean anything. And which gets at one of my biggest pet peeves of, reporting, which I won't dwell on too long, which is that people always ask potential reporters have like very limited time with these potential candidates for president. And they always ask them if they're going to run, knowing full well that the person is not going to tell you.
They never say, they never say like, yes, on a random TV station or something. They never do that. But we always ask anyway.
Exactly. I know it drives me insane. Like if you're going to run for president, you're going to do a big announcement with a podium and supporters and balloons and a banner. You're not just going to casually drop it on a Tuesday, you know, because some reporter asked you, so, and then there's all this parsing of their language and, you know, oh, she left the door open. It doesn't matter. You can lie. You can lie and there's no, you know, retribution for it. Obama said many times he would not run. He was going to serve out his full Senate term. That was completely false and it never really, you know, was held against him. But now we're getting far afield. Yeah. So I mean, what do you think? Like, do you think
when I think about what you're saying and sort of like the figure, so Warren is really popular with the Democratic base in sort of the same way that Ted Cruz is popular with the Republican or the conservative base. But the difference is that Cruz is much more willing to leave a presidential run open, and whether or not he decides to do that, which I think he will, it gives him more gravitas and it sort of gives him more influence to push his policy positions. And Warren doesn't do that. And I wonder,
that's a really
like,
good point.
You know, why doesn't she, why not, maybe not disavow it so much, but why not leave the door open so she's more of a nuisance to the serious presidential candidates, as in the ones who want to run and want to win, like Clinton and Martin O'Malley and, you know, push them on that position, because it's more like, it's much easier to rev people up and rev your base up if they think you're going to run for president. For some reason, a lot of Americans, I think, don't sort of immediately recognize the value of just applying pressure for pressure's sake, and sort of the value of just having not radicals, but people sort of pushing the extremes. And there are a lot of examples in history about this. My favorite one is sort of like the argument during actual the Civil War, where Lincoln, sort of not as much of a advocate of ending slavery at the beginning, but through, you know, the pressure of William Seward and Thaddeus Stevens, he sort of moved more in that direction. And like, whether Warren runs or not, if you're a Democrat, I think and if you're a Republican, and whether Cruz runs or not, there's value in having that pressure there and having a force sort of calling attention to those ideas to avoid the anointing, like you said.
Yeah.
For Warren, I think it's just, if she doesn't, she wants to be obviously much more delicate about this. But you're like, that letter to that banking letter was so clearly directed at Third Way. Yeah. I don't even know if it was like a subtweet. It was just like a tweet in what you mean. But you think that the coverage of that, and this will be a good way to segue into your piece, which I really want to talk about. But you think the coverage of this was sort of fair, that Warren was ready for a fight here, and the letter sort of shows that, and she's ready to throw down about this and defend her economic populism and her calls for tighter regulation of Wall Street and sort of be the standard bearer for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was like, it was overblown in some ways and sensationalized in a way that the media is want to do, you know, probably myself mm-hmm. included. But I think it's fine from a media kind of perspective, media ethics perspective, because there is a real divide there. You know, it's not like they invented a divide. That is a really very real salient divide within the Democratic base, the progressive base. So, you know, I think like war analogies might be a little bit strong, but it touched on something. It was it was indirect. It was, polite and professional. And, it wasn't like she said much stronger things about the banks in the past, but it absolutely touched on a real, divide there. And I think the media was right to tease that out and to, you know, give it some attention. And, if I take off my reporter hat and put on my like progressive hat, I think that's a good thing. Like, you know, I think she should be doing everything she can to move, if she really believes what she's doing. And, you know, if you're a progressive, she should be doing everything she can to keep these issues on the table and to move the party slightly to the left. The question is whether she is doing it for her own self-interest or for her ideals. I think she's doing it for her ideals. And in some sense, there's not a big difference between the two, since she is the best conduit for these ideals.
Right.
But, So I think it's fairly, fair.
Well, to close out here, I mean, it's also good to remember that she's not alone. I don't really know where we are in this, but I know a little while during, earlier in the year, I think there were announcements about sort of the domino effect of party chairmanships. And for the Senate Banking Committee, it was really funny because essentially there was a seniority list for who would take the banking committee next. And I think that's still up in the air. I might be wrong. And it was supposed to like go to Chuck Schumer next, but he sort of signaled that seemed really unlikely. And then it was supposed to go to someone else and that seemed unlikely. So it's like sort of likely that it'll go to Sherrod Brown, who's a big populist and sort of is in that sort of wing and of the Democratic Party in the same way. So I wouldn't, and I think from what I've seen of Brown, he is even pricklier or more ready to sort of get in and throw down about certain things and sort of the labor issues like Warren.
Yep.
So I think you could see sort of a ballooning of what we're seeing on the right, on the left here, especially around fiscal issues and like, and things
that,
you know, you, like you said, young liberals are really pissed off about. They are really unhappy. They were told, you know, if we elect President Obama, we're going to have jobs, and they don't. They're broke.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's dissatisfaction on both sides, and it's, I think it's going to result in something else. The question is, you know, is the media going to blow this out of proportions or not? And I think a good example of whether of examining how the media covers a topic is with the rollout of the healthcare website.
Nice transition.
See how I made that segue?
Very nice.
There?
Well done.
You like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you wrote a really good piece, which, and the lead was really good, which was sort of like, you know, Obama's in real trouble here. Things aren't going well. There's this big issue going on and his administration is getting all the blame for it. And of course I'm talking about, what was it? Was
the BP oil
it
spill.
Wasn't, yeah, it was the BP oil spill, which I really remember. And it was just, you know, everyone was talking about it and everyone was like, Obama, do something. And you cited examples after that of like other areas where Obama, where this was going to be Obama's Alamo, Obama's, Katrina moment, Obama's big sort of downfall in one episode. And it's not even, like, my take from your piece is that it wasn't even that it didn't turn out to be that. It was sort of that just the passage of time and sort of the coverage and sort of the sort of perspective was lost in these moments of crisis.
Yeah, I think I think that's absolutely right. I mean, in the middle of one of these firestorms, like if you go back to mid-November, I think the 17th was the date that the House voted on Fred Upton's bill, which was like the Republican, you know, people can keep their coverage bill. That's where I would kind of mark the peak of the media firestorm around the healthcare.gov website. And in the middle of it, it absolutely looked like Obama's done. He's like, what can he possibly do? You know, it's just wall-to-wall coverage on cable news. Every single almost news story online is about it. Democrats are jumping ship. And, you know, everybody's mind has a tendency to extrapolate things linearly going forward. So it's really bad now. I don't see a way that it's going to fix, so it's just going to get worse. And that's just a kind of cognitive bias that we all have, including people in the media. And they tend to lose sight of history or realize that things change, which is kind of astonishing. So they just assume that it's going to get worse and worse and worse and that Obama, you know, will never recover. And it's just, one of the things that I did to report that, quote, report it using Nexus reporting, which is one of my favorite kinds of reporting, is I just punched in, you know, can Obama recover, ? In quotes, and got dozens, hundreds of stories going back to 2007. You know, Reverend Wright comes out, can Obama recover?
Yeah.
Henry Louis Gates arrest and Obama calls it stupid. This is the beer summit thing. Can Obama recover? BP oil spill, can Obama recover? Hurricane Sandy, can Obama recover? You know, I'm forgetting like a half a dozen of them, but there are so many.
I remember right when Obama jumped into the race and he called like Hillary Clinton Bush Cheney light. And my friend was like, Obama is done. You know, it was over. And it was this tiny or remember when Joe Biden called Obama like, what was it? It was clean or neat.
Oh yeah.
Or something.
Articulate.
And then
like that,
at the time, if you had told any political analyst like, oh, and by the way, Joe Biden's going to be his VP, they would be like, no, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Did you hear what he just said? It's insane.
What about your gaffes, Obama?
Yeah. What about your gaffes?
Yeah.
But I mean, my question going away, well, my question is twofold about this. One thing is that, so last week I went to the American Legislative Exchange Council They had this event in D.C., and Ted Cruz spoke. And one thing he said there, which really surprised me, was that he said, eventually they'll figure out this healthcare website thing, but that's not why we should oppose Obamacare anyway. We should oppose it because it's a bad law. Mm. That's what he said. That surprised me because aren't we supposed to be saying right now that the doom and gloom, like the fact that the healthcare.gov website, the rollout was terrible and there are a lot of kinks in it right now. Isn't that supposed to mark, like, why would you say that if you're a conservative? But he did say that.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And
Eric Erickson.
It doesn't seem like some, right. And so you have these big influential figures in the GOP saying this, but you don't have a lot of the media sort of framing that in the, forgive me for saying, for using the word narrative here, but you don't have that.
Yeah.
Why don't we see that, Alex? I mean, is it just sort of the excitement of the moment?
Yeah.
Or, and to be fair also, like, unlike the other disasters, this is Obama's signature thing. This is the thing that he promised the American people.
Right.
You know, he said, this is going to change everything. He told red state Democrats, listen, you got to back me on this. You just have to stick with me on this. We've got your back here, but you got to go with me here. And as far as I can tell, most of the red state Dems up for re-election were planning on doing that. They were not planning on, you know, saying that the healthcare website had problems.
Right.
So, where do you think the disconnect is?
Well, I think it's a few things, and I'll try to remember all of them as you were talking. That you just had to say. The first, yeah, let's get out of the way. The to be sure, the caveat. I mean, this was a big mess up. I would use a different word if I could. I don't know if I can on Blogging Heads, but you know, it starts with an F, and you know the word. This is a huge fiasco. there's no doubt about that. I mean, this was, you know, and if you're a liberal, I think you should absolutely be furious at the president for doing this. Like, you got, this is the most important progressive accomplishment in generations, something that seven presidents have tried to do. You finally got it. You made it through the House. You made it through the Senate. You made it through Scott Brown's election when it looked like it was doomed. You made it through the Supreme Court when it looked like it was doomed. And then, you know, on the final yard, when the ball is entirely in your control, you just fumble it, like a completely unforced error, to mix my sports metaphors. That's unforgivable. That is really inexcusable. Like, this was entirely in your control, and you messed it up and potentially jeopardized the most important progressive accomplishment in generations. But if you're the thing is, you can fix it, right? You know, like, you can come back in 2 months and you can fix the website, and you know, you should still be like, we still need to have a hard conversation about what happened here and make sure that doesn't happen again and fix it. But I think what the media, I think they're just eager for a scandal. There's this Brendan Nyhan, a political scientist at Dartmouth who studies the media, is one of my favorite academics. And he's written a lot about scandals and how scandals become a thing. And he has found that in the second term of presidents is when scandals become a thing, that the election is over. You need a, you know, kind of a new storyline. And in order for a scandal to, reach scandal proportions, in order to go from a controversy to a scandal, you need to have the opposition party and the media both in having interests pointing in the same direction. It's not that they're colluding. It's that they both have, you know, self-interest that point in the same direction. So Republicans always have an interest in, you know, ginning up scandal. But in a second term, when there's not much else going on, the media does. And I think they especially do at a time, you know, after spending all of October just absolutely annihilating Republicans for the government shutdown, and, you know, mainstream reporters just completely pooping all over Republicans, I think they like to have a balance of, now we can attack the president. And, you know, I think that we could also get into, I think there's a media bias thing here, in that conservatives are right that most reporters are liberal, like, with, you know, without a doubt, most people who work on TV, cable news, objective reporters are liberal. They live in urban environments. They, you know, mm-hmm. went to, many have graduate degrees. If you just look at their demographics, they are liberal. So I think, but they take their jobs very seriously. They don't want to be biased. They want to be independent journalists. So I think there's sometimes a tendency to be more sympathetic to Republican ideas, and they're looking for opportunities to attack a Democratic president because it can show that they are objective and they're independent. Look, like, we can be just as hard on Obama as we were on Bush, because the media is very hard on Bush. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a prime there. But then just in general, there's always going to be an interest, if you're a columnist or, you know, a pundit, there's always an interest in having a strong statement. No one's interested in, well, the website is not good, but maybe it will be fixed, blah, blah, blah. No, like, Obama is over. This is a disaster. That's way more interesting, you know, and I can see it in what I write. And if I write something with a very strong point of view, it does better in traffic. And then my editors like me more, and then that's good for me. So I have I'm conditioned to keep doing that. So I think there's always going to be some of that, no matter what, and that's fine. And, you know, the one problem going forward is, and this happened with the IRS scandal, and I think we're going to see the same thing happening with this scandal, there's always a ton of coverage of the scandal itself. You know, oh, it's terrible, it's terrible. But then once it kind of works its way out, and once the IRS scandal, quote unquote, was revealed to not really be that big of a deal at all, you know, it actually wasn't Watergate, it wasn't the IRS targeting Tea Party groups. We learned that later on. There's very little coverage cleaning up the mess, because it's way less interesting, and it's kind of embarrassing. You know, you have to kind of admit you were wrong. And I think that's going to be the same thing that's going to happen here. All the pundits who were, you know, doom and gloom about the healthcare website are not going to come back and say, oh, the website's fixed, like, well done. And I've been, you know, keeping track of the metrics just in, like, Nexus and TV mentions, and it's already gone way down. So what happens is it just kind of fades into the rearview mirror, and there's never an accounting of what the media went wrong. What got wrong.
So it sounds like you're one of these reporters who really would like to see, like, highlighting columnists and pundits who just got something insanely wrong. Like, the analysis was so off. And, you know, the columnist or the pundit say, yeah, I was completely wrong.
Yeah.
I get that. I think as a, you know, for columnists, I'm not a columnist, but, like, there's a fear that you instant, like, your credibility is a one-time thing. And if you say you're wrong on something, but the pundits that I like a lot on the right and the left, every once in a while, they'll say, I just got it wrong. And, you know, it turned out that's how, events work. You know, that's news.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you one other thing about sort of the coverage of the rollout. You know, what the thing that the really legitimate claim, I think, is really not, you know, the website being, or the legitimate ongoing criticism is really not the website. It is, to me, and please call me out on this here, it's, you know, the Obama's, you know, promise and the John Kerry promise, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Thing. And it's, you know, we have a reporter who is focusing on Obamacare almost full time. And, you know, he said that there was going to be something like this. Like, there were going to be some insurance plans that people like that didn't adhere to the law, but generally, so this law could work, they would have to drop.
Yeah.
And this law, and to be fair, this law is huge. It's really technical, and it's really hard to understand. It's really complex. But, you know, like, and I remember a great ProPublica story on an example of this, of a family of two that had a plan they really liked, and it was really good for them, and they had to drop it. They lost it because of Obamacare. Do you think there's been proportional coverage, A, of, like, that fact, and B, like, I mean, because we haven't seen that as much as, like, the healthcare website is terrible, which is a much easier headline to write. But do you think the coverage of that has been fair, and that the criticism of that has been fair, is right?
No, and then there has been some coverage of that. I mean, and there were legislative fixes proposed. You know, the Upton bill was to address that. But, yeah, you're right. Like, I mean, I feel I almost never accuse politicians of lying, because you don't know what's going on in their head. You know, Although I realized I accused Obama of lying earlier in this segment when he said he wasn't going to run for president. Maybe that could have been wrong, because maybe he honestly thought he wasn't going to run for president and then he changed his mind. So I'll retract my lie accusation there and now redeploy it on the White House and Obama. And I think with this, if you like your coverage, you can keep it. I think that was pretty much a lie, plain and simple. I think they knew that a small minority of people were going to lose their plans. And we're going to have to buy new plans. And they said it anyway, because the true statement, which Obama has started saying now, is much less bumper stickerable. You know, like if you get your coverage through an employer or through the government or through several other options and you like your plan, then you can keep it. But if you are on the individual market and you have a substandard plan and, you know, blah, 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 then maybe you won't be able to keep it. It's just like, you know, like for something like 97% of cases, I think it was correct, but in drawing a hard line, I think it's false. I don't think it's that big of a deal. I mean, you know, politicians lie. It's a job requirement. And if you compare it to like what Republicans have said about the Affordable Care Act, from like death panels to socialized medicine to government takeover of healthcare, you know, it's a pretty small one. But yeah, it is a lie. And I think the media is right to take the administration to tax for that. I find it hard to get up in arms about something that's 97% true. But yeah, I mean, it was a lie. It's just a fairly white lie in the scheme of things.
So to close out today, Alex, because we're over, this is longer than what I pitched for this Blogging Heads episode. You know, I wanted to go back to, you know, the incentives to sort of inflate or to, as a reporter, or not, you know, just in general, the journalism industry to make a big deal about something. And it's really hard, I think, because we're in this sort of like hyper sensational sort of period of journalism where there's so much content produced each day and it's so fast to get attention. You need to have, it can't just be, you know, there are some problems with the healthcare.gov website. Right. And, you know, there are some problems. It's not that bad. It's sort of bad. I don't know. I'm like, because you're competing with other outlets and other sharp reporters and the time demands are so great. I'm semi-sympathetic like you to that, but like I think it's important to, and you hit on this, but it's like an important fact that we're looking at. As if you're a consumer of news, you kind of need to take a lot of things with a grain of salt. There are publications, I'm sure you know as well, that like to exaggerate things and make a bigger deal about them. And have a habit of doing that, partially because it's, you know, as a reader, it's more exciting to read that. It's like going to an action movie. It's more exciting to see explosions and stuff and sort of like a chase than, or like the prospect of something.
Yep. No, it's true.
I mean,
yeah. So how do we move forward? How do we be better?
You said, you know, this, it seems like this is here to stay. So with everything, with the civil war, with on the left and the right, with the coverage of the Affordable Care Act, running for president, lies, and the lying liars who tell them. Are we going to see that go away? Is it going to be, I mean, because we've sort of like, I think we're definitely in the age of Twitter, where like when something gets picked up, it gets picked up, but when it doesn't, and, you know, sort of things dissolve very quickly, is that going to disappear?
So I will turn this back on you too, because this is tough. It's a good question. I don't think it will disappear. Here's my gut, and I don't think the media angle, the media part of it, will disappear. That interest will always be there. I think it always has been there. I would just like to see a little bit of accountability, and I'll give some props to Chris Saliza at the Washington Post, who I also complimented on Twitter several times. He said he had written a column a while ago, like in July, that the nuclear option would never happen. He said it'll never come to pass. And then after it did come to pass, you know, last week or 2 weeks ago, he wrote a column saying, I got this wrong. Like, I, you know, and here's why I got it wrong and whatnot. And I thought that was really, really impressive and cool. And I think that's awesome. And I, you know, I get stuff wrong.
I've and look at him. He's still employed.
And he's still employed. Exactly. You know, and if any, my stock of he's gone up tremendously in my book. So I would just like to see a little bit more of that. You know, it's transparency essentially. So I'm cautiously optimistic.
I definitely, I'm convinced, and I hadn't really sort of heard a good explanation until now about why, like, the reasons we should have. I mean, it's not even that, you know, pundits should just say they're wrong because they're wrong, but, like, you sort of, they seem more human, and it doesn't seem, like, I'm still gonna, if there's a columnist or pundit who said, you know, this Obamacare rollout shows that the law is terrible, and, you know, it turns out not to be so bad, or, you know, Elizabeth Warren will never run for president, and she turns out too, and then they go back and say, yeah, I mean, this is the information I had at the time, and this is what I went with, and I was wrong, and, you know, I was wrong, but this is what's happening now. Their stock will go up in my book too.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I'm not going to boycott them because they were wrong once, because I am wrong all the time. And we're all humans.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, okay, Alex, that's all I've got. Thank you so much for doing this with me. This is a real pleasure.
Yeah, this is fun.
You know, and it's, yeah. So, I think I'm going to see you like soon at some social event. So, I will talk to you then.
Sounds good. Thanks for doing this.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for doing this. All right. Bye.